This is a question, one sentence, three parts. Mr. Boyd, would you agree with Mr. Chite that the administration, quote, might or might not have been right about the administration decision to call in the cops? B, do you believe that people should rot in jail for a decision that might or might not be right, as Mr. Chite indicated? And C, if you don't believe that people should rot in jail for a decision that, quote, might or might not have been right, as Mr. Chite indicated, why aren't you for amnesty?
That's a very tough one to answer, because that first part is, do I agree that it might or might not have been right? This strikes me as awfully hard to respond to. But let me try weaseling around it first, and then I'll try to give you what my own considered judgment is. I wish my experience with the style didn't make me as timid as it does right now. At this point, most of you are deploring the consequences of a decision that brought policemen onto this campus. And it has had deplorable consequences. The fact that we are here at midnight is evidence of that. So we don't even need to argue about that. But if the other decision had been made, the decision not to insist on the enforcement of law and order on this campus, there would also be people who were unhappy, including some of you and some of us. I regret very much that we got into the position where it seemed necessary to bring police on this campus, and I regret the consequences of their having been brought, but I cannot honestly say I regret that the decision was made, because I think that if this university is going to continue to be a great university, it is going to have to admit that the rule of law must prevail here, and that we must try to find methods other than those which you call confrontational for resolving various conflicts that come up. Now,
please quiet, order. All the way in the back there, the man with his hand up with his blue sweater and the white jacket.
Areas in student life and concern in which that is exactly true. I do not, however, believe that all lawmaking, law enforcement authority on campus should be turned over to students, because faculty and administration and alumni are also vital parts of this university, and there are some parts of it that you ought to control because it affects only your life. And there are some parts that ought to be a community concern, and we need to have some form of effective community government, not some one group being the dictator on the campus.
Question back here, the girl in the dark blue sweater.
Why did you not then say that they were not obstructing as they were not? And why were the doors kept locked as that was an obstruction?
Okay. You know, by now I think that my accent reveals the fact that I'm from the South, and I'm from South Carolina, and I left South Carolina, and I detested many things about it because of what has come to be called tokenism in life there. And I rejected tokenism in South Carolina, and I rejected tokenism in this building today when a very narrow and, as it proved, quite temporary little aisle was being passed off as ending the obstruction of the building.
Did he at all discuss the possibilities of a mistake with the faculty or with the students, with the ASUC president, for instance, or for that matter, the faculty, which I consider a more important consideration of such an important issue? Did he ask, or for that matter, does he have such total authority? Or, again, putting the question more specifically, should he have such total authority?
I hate to be responsible for repeating it, but the essence of it was that when Mr. Chite was using this 2 hours to make his decision that finally led to the police being brought on the campus, whether or not he had consulted with others, most particularly with the faculty, or whether or not he had this power to do it without consultation, or do I think he should have such power. Now, I cannot answer that satisfactorily, and I wish you had asked Mr. Chite that question when he was here. I think, as many of you know, during the period of that crucial 2 hours, when I would be willing to stake my career on the fact that there was consultation going on, I was at that time downstairs in the basement of the same building, and there are a good number of you here know that it was because at one part of the campus, some attempt was being made to end the situation by voluntary compliance, that at another part of the campus, it would have been irresponsible at least not to be giving consideration to what should be done if the efforts to achieve voluntary compliance failed. But I can't really answer several parts of your question.
Okay, I'm going to have two more questions. This man back here in the green jacket.
Considerable part, I agree that it's a terrible indictment of us all that it takes a crisis to bring us together.
Last question, Mo Hirsch.
You say that you want some imaginative solutions that no one has thought of yet. We hear cries for creative solutions. Well, if we argue that a strike is creative, but I'll ask you, what do you offer us if the strike is called off? You say you won't bring police on campus to settle a political dispute. There was a political dispute. The dispute was who had the right to set up tables there. And you settled this dispute by calling the cops. Now, you say you won't do this in the future. You say you will give the students the powers to make rules. You haven't offered one of those things. You just offered vague generalities.
I think that this campus, which is so preoccupied with questions of power, is also incredibly naive about some questions of power. you attribute to the Chancellor's office and now to one splinter of it, this particular Vice Chancellor's office, far more power than in fact exists. If I am talking in generalizations, I'm fully aware of that and as uneasy about it as anyone in this audience. But it's going to take a lot of hard work on the part of all of us sitting around conference tables in order to move from the general to the specific. I don't have the solution in my pocket. I didn't claim that I did.
Okay. We'll have another speaker and then we'll vote on the question described.
The last speaker. Yes! Oh, please, can I please have order? Can I please have order?
Yes, they want to hear
him. If you don't want to hear, all right, I'll take a straw vote. All those who would like to hear Mario Savio speak before we have a vote, please raise your hand. All those who do not, please raise your hand. The ayes clearly have it. Mario Savio will speak, and then we'll take a vote.
I started out today with the intention of going to a birthday party for my baby. And I ended up in jail. I came to the protest downstairs in this building accidentally. I wasn't in on any of the conspiracy. And I stayed for the fun. There's a question which we're trying to decide whether or not we should have a strike. And as you probably can guess, I'm in favor of a strike. And I'd like to just say some of the reasons why. Though really, a lot of them have been said, a lot of that has been expressed fairly well by someone in the back over there and by Professor Hirsch. The history of the last 2 years of this place, at least, makes it very clear to me that we obtain results only when we have the power to do what the Chancellor has said he doesn't want to have done here, to coerce. Now, many of us here, I suppose, would like not to have to think of our actions in that way, and it would be pleasanter and would tax our consciences less if we could look upon our actions as only a way of communicating our ideas to the Chancellor's office and to the Board of Regents. But that really is not the case, and I think we should be very honest about what a strike would be about. It would be an attempt to offer to the administration alternatives, no one of which is pleasant. That's a form of coercion. Now, I'd like to make clear with regard to one part of the strike demands I've heard. I wasn't around when people drew up tentative strike demands. One part of them is the same as the Council of Campus Organizations position on due process in university hearings. That's the part of them that I know most about. I've been engaged in helping to formulate those demands on due process, not just this year. The formulation of those demands began at least 2 years ago. All through the spring of 1965, after the free speech movement had subsided, I and others, both among the students and in the faculty, attempted to communicate to people in the administration, and I think did so in a fairly articulate manner, in the small group meetings that the Vice Chancellor was talking about, around conference tables, what our desires were in the way of fair university hearings, what we felt would be appropriate as canons of due process to bind university hearings. Our demands on those, you know, on those questions were compatible with, though made more specific, the December 8th resolutions, which the Berkeley faculty had passed the previous winter by a vote of 824 to 115. I want to make some things very clear, which maybe we don't bear in mind constantly enough. The faculty, potentially, maybe actually far more powerful than we, voted by over 7-1 for certain civil liberties positions. The Board of Regents never adopted what the faculty voted by so powerful, you know, by so powerful a majority. That's very important to understand. Because if the Vice Chancellor suggests that we attempt to persuade people in the administration of the correctness of our view in small meetings around conference tables, when considering how realistic a suggestion that might be, we must take into account, into consideration, the fact that the overwhelmingly expressed will of the Berkeley faculty was ignored and in one specific instance directly rebuffed by the Board of Regents. In the case of most of the five of the December 8th resolutions, the Board simply ignored what the faculty did. In the case of one specific one, where the faculty asked once again to have power over students' discipline in areas only involving political questions, the Board specifically rejected this idea. That was back then, when we were much more powerful than we have ever been, and when the faculty, at least for one day, was clearly on our side. More recently, so as to reduce the feeling in some people that possibly the administration position has changed, I want to say, much more recently, this question was again opened. I took part with Vice Chancellor Boyd very recently in a conference, a very small meeting, a pre-hearing conference prior to the hearing the university administration has offered me on the question of my readmission to the university. The conference, I assure you, was very small. It was attended by the Vice Chancellor, Boyd, by Executive Vice Chancellor Earl Chite, whom I believe you've heard, by a secretary of theirs, by the Regents' Council, who for 2 years on has been interfering in the internal affairs of this campus, and who is the person, Mrs. Milton Gordon, who finally ended up supporting Mrs. Athau in her attempt to open university files of certain kinds. In addition, there was myself and my attorney, Malcolm Bernstein. We made on the Chancellor specific demands concerning the nature of the hearing he was prepared to grant me. Those demands, a little bit more expressed in greater detail in some respects, are essentially the Council of Campus Organizations' position on due process. Most of the time, it was impossible to obtain any decision from the from the Vice Chancellor as to his opinion concerning specifically enumerated due process demands. When he did express his opinion, he said no. On one occasion, and I say this not to embarrass the Vice Chancellor, but to make it very clear in public the nature of university government here, on one occasion when my attorney was asking a very important question, I was watching very carefully the Vice Chancellor's eyes. He was not looking at Mal. He was looking directly and very intently at Executive Vice Chancellor Earl Chite. The question had not been addressed to Chite. Chait was not the person formally with the power to make the decision. The Vice Chancellor began to nod, and instantly thereafter, Mr. Boyd informed us that what we were then asking was, you know, was acceptable or at least could be considered. I think that's a very important matter for us to consider, and it is only one instance of the great experience that some of us have had concerning the inner workings of their organization. They know, and before today's events, knew very well what our demands concerning due process, you know, are. They knew it back in 1964. They knew it even more clearly in 1965. The only time the question comes up for serious resolution, serious discussion, is when we have the power, to compel certain actions on their part. Now that compulsion can be very disruptive. And I am no more in favor of disruptive compulsion than is the Vice Chancellor. I think that's why a strike is a much better idea than one of the other things which can be done. We could, for example, have sit-ins, which eventually we would need, because if the experience of small group meetings and conferences which we have had is at all to be relied upon, they will be successful and meaningful only when outside there stands waiting a non-violent standing army. That is the experience of 2 years. In the case of a strike, all you have to do is stay away from classes. Heaven knows we've all missed enough of them in our academic careers. There's a period of time between now and finals when I think very likely most people will gain more in the direction of preparing for those finals by staying home than by going to class. This is a very non-disruptive way, very non-disruptive, though very powerful way, of enforcing our will, of making our ideas be considered seriously by the university administration. Look at what we're up against. The due process demands we've made, and the position the Berkeley faculty took in 1964, is in direct opposition with positions of the Board of Regents. When we make demands for due process in university hearings, we're not making them on Vice Chancellor Boyd, who might well be very, you know, very well personally disposed to accepting those demands. We make them on the statewide administration, on the Board of Regents. They're not going to meet with us in some small group discussion. They probably won't let us in to speak with them. In the past, they have not. Now, circumstances may be different. With the governor-elect, I doubt it. Not a question of a small group discussion. We are making demands on the Board of Regents, on the statewide administration, for changes in the structure of government here. Because for them to grant us the due process demands we've made means they have to relinquish a great deal of their power in politically sensitive areas. It is my firm conviction that no small group meetings will do any good at all unless at the same time those meetings are going on, we constantly, non-disruptively, but forcefully maintain the power to take other action and maintain that power in a form which constitutes powerful action at the time the discussions are going on. I can't think of a better way, of a way which would less hurt academic careers and other careers than by a strike. And for those reasons, I strongly urge that we vote to have a strike. Thank you.
Yes.
We're going to go.
Again, used force to suppress student concern over denial of our rights and misuse of our student union. We therefore move that there be a strike tomorrow to take place until noon, at which time there be a rally on Sproul Hall steps. When the continuation of the strike will come up for questioning. Further, these sub-demands. We demand that students have the same rights on campus given to the Navy. We demand policemen not be called onto campus against student movements. I'm sorry that you're correct. We demand that students and non-students have the same right on campus given to the Navy. We demand that policemen not be called onto campus against student movements. We demand amnesty from the university for our fellow demonstrators. We demand that due process, open hearings, and judicial review be granted to students in terms of the December 8th resolutions and the United States Constitution. Further, we demand that students have control over student affairs, i.e., that students be represented in policymaking which regards the use of campus facilities, political activities, and registered and non-registered students.
I would like all people, we're going to have an immediate vote now, all people in favor of the motion, please raise your hand. All people opposed. The ayes clearly have it.
Victory!
At noon today, December 1st, the planned rally was held on the Sproul Hall steps, with 8,000 to 10,000 persons in attendance. Many of the speakers were ones who had been heard earlier on this program, and much of what they said had been said by them or by others during the debate before the strike vote was taken. However, one speaker, Hal Draper, added a comment on some of the things said by representatives of the administration when he said that many issues had been discussed, but that only one was really basic.
That within 2 hours, that figure is Mr. Tite. Last night, within 2 hours, the administration acted to settle their dialogue with the student protesters by calling the cops to the campus. Within 2 hours, they sought to settle this question by convincing the people they arrested in Santa Rita. That was their idea of negotiation. And it's closely connected with the fact that they refused to make clear that they're not going to act analogously now against students. The police invasion and the arrest, as well as the amnesty issue, this is the immediate dynamic of this strike. Otherwise, it probably would not have taken place. Last night, Vice Chancellor Boyd came before the meeting of 2,000 or 3,000 students up there, and he made a plea. He made a plea with them not to go on strike, but for imaginative, creative responses, he said. And that Berkeley should be a model for the country for imaginative responses and creative answers to difficulties that occur between the administration and the students. How much imagination do you think it took for Mr. Chite to make the decision within 2 hours to settle this question by the imaginative and creative method of police clubs on the heads of the students?
Another speaker was Dan McIntosh, president of the student government, who attended the rally to announce some later developments. He said that he had been in touch with the National Student Association, which had promised its support for the student strike, and he went on to make this announcement.
I simply want to convey to you something that happened last night in the AFCC Senate, which I think is significantly different than happened in 1954, to say the least. The AFCC Senate last night voted to support a protest strike, this protest strike that is going on. to stand behind demands, that have been expressed that non-students all around this community be treated equally. And the AFUC intends, contrary to 1964, and I intend, contrary to 1964, to do everything that we can to represent these viewpoints and to make sure that the administration deals with these considerations in the manner that they should have been dealing with them for the past 2 years.
The last speaker of the rally was Mario Savio, and at the conclusion of his talk, he held two votes. In one, he asked for a vote on the demands which had been adopted as the goals of the student strike. In the other, he asked for a vote on whether or not to continue the strike. It was not clear just how many persons voted, although there were certainly several thousand. Several thousand supported the demands and continuation of the strike. 20 or 30 persons voted no on each issue. While the rally went on, the Navy recruiters, whose presence had been the catalyst for the latest demonstrations, sat at a table where they could see and hear everything that went on. They had been moved to the outside steps of the Student Union building. The university announced that it had requested the move after a request to that effect from the student government. It also said that for the remaining 2 days that the recruiters would be on campus, the table would be manned by student members of the Navy Reserve Officers Training Corps. Up to at least noon today, however, it was manned by 3 non-students, a commander and 2 lieutenant commanders. As we have been broadcasting this program, an ad hoc meeting of faculty members is in session on the university campus. Scott Keach has been covering the meeting, and just a moment or two ago, he phoned in this report.
This is Scott Keach calling from the University of California campus. There is at this moment a meeting of perhaps 250 to 300 faculty members going on in Dwinnell Hall. At the last moment that I was in the meeting, no decisions had been reached. So it's not possible to report on this as we might normally do. And what I thought I might do instead is simply run down in sort of chronological order the things that have happened since I arrived, the points which have been made in discussion. When I arrived, a professor, Leon Woolsey, was speaking. He was talking about what he considered to have been a miscalculation on the part of the administration in the way it responded to the student demonstration yesterday. He asked whether or not it was merely a procedural and administrative miscalculation, or a much more basic miscalculation of the entire problem, not only on this campus, but in the society at large. He said that he had been conscious of an approach in which all of the blame was put on 6 non-students, or 2 years ago on Mario Savio and one or two other people, when the real problem here, or at Harvard, or at any other university, or in the society at large, was a much more basic, much deeper problem, especially in a time of war. He said he agreed with the student strike demand that there be no police on campus. He proposed that a faculty student committee with no administrative members, or at most with an administrative minority, be appointed to deal with the problems which seem to exist. Professor Philip Selznick spoke next. He noted that the Academic Senate has a regularly scheduled meeting next Monday, but he too referred to the problem that there seemed to be a much more basic problem here than merely an administrative miscalculation or an irresponsible response by students to an administrative act. He said that something must be done in constitutional terms, by which I understood him to mean that the problem was not merely to deal with specifics, but to reform the basic rules and perhaps even the basic approach to student administration and faculty relations. Professor Dundees of the Anthropology Department pointed out that students face a very serious problem, that final examinations are coming up very shortly, since this is the first of the quarters under the new system. final examinations will not be given after but before Christmas vacation. He himself suggested that faculty members give take-home examinations, which the students could take home during the last week of classes and deal with at their leisure and have some idea of what kind of reviewing they had to do. He said that he proposed this not as something that everyone should necessarily do, but that the faculty should be thinking in terms of what it could do for students in general. A professor whose name I missed, who's in the philosophy department and who is new to the campus, said that it had been his impression during this quarter here, his first quarter here, that the university administration had normally given worse arguments than its actual position. He then went on to list some of the situations which he had seen since being here, but said that his overall impression had been that students and faculty did not respect the rules which the administration makes, and that he could not see any reason why they should be respected. He asked who makes the rules. He said that the only response that seemed to him to be open to students is pressure, not rational debate. He said that when Chancellor Hines announced that the students would no longer be allowed to use the Sproul Hall steps, the faculty made no protest, but the students did. He concluded that he cannot understand the principle on which the administration operates this university. A professor of physics, Sherwood Parker, who said that he's a member of the Academic Freedom Committee, said that the question of the Sproul Hall steps had been discussed before that committee, but that it was decided that the issue was not academic freedom as such, but that then individual members pointed out to the Chancellor's Special Assistant, John Searle, who is at the meeting, that they felt that the action would not be advisable and that he personally felt that that recommendation had carried no weight. He also said, as some of the others had, that he felt that the administration responded only to coercion, again, not to debate. Mr. Searle replied that he thought that Mr. Parker overrated the force of coercion, that he had been impressed, for example, about the Sproul Hall steps because students came in and talked to him and talked to the chancellor. He said, in addition, that the idea of changing the Sproul Hall steps was a recommendation of the Rules Committee, of which a majority of the members are faculty. He said that the Chancellor rarely overrides Rules Committee recommendations, that he did override a recommendation on this, that is to say, he did not put through the change because he was impressed by the force of argument against it. Another professor whose name I missed noted that there's a problem of deciding between political and non-political acts, that at a time of war, that something like the Navy recruiting on this campus is a political act. He asked who caused the disorder. He said that the sit-down that the students engaged in yesterday seemed to him to be an anti-violent act, in that it was taken only to keep there from being further violence when an outbreak of violence broke out between two people. He also said that a dean had staked his reputation on pledging to the students that nothing would happen to them if they ended the demonstration. One of the major points of the student demands and the strike has been a pledge of no disciplinary action. This professor went on to say that the dean, after having granted or staked his reputation on this, went back and talked to Mr. Searle and Chancellor Hines, and that they approved this action, but he said no one was informed of it. This professor went on to say that he thought the strike was justified. Many of the people in the room applauded. There are a number of students around the back and in the aisles of the room, but many of the faculty members seated throughout this large lecture hall in Dwinnell Hall also applauded, and the applause went on for some time. He went on to say that he supported most of the other demands of the strike. Professor Searle, the chancellor's special assistant, got up to start to reply to some of the points which had been made. He was interrupted by a man shouting out, "Why isn't the Chancellor here?" That was greeted by very long applause. Mr. Searle said that the Chancellor is meeting with some faculty groups and student groups tonight and that he couldn't come to this one. He was, however, sent from the room to try to get the Chancellor. Just before he went, he said that he objected to this approach that a distinction should be made between political and non-political acts, that would be a problem of judgment that he didn't think the Chancellor should be saddled with, although the Chancellor does have to make a great many decisions which are purely a matter of judgment. He was then, as he was leaving, one of the faculty members said that the entire problem is one of judgment, that the Chancellor and his vice-chancellors and assistants thought that they were right, that the regulation that they were supporting in trying to halt the student demonstration yesterday was a right regulation, and that they thought that they therefore had the right to call in the police, and that this is what the faculty objected to. Mr. Searle then went. Then there was an interruption as faculty members said that they were not entirely sure what the students were demanding, and one of the representatives of the student strike was at the meeting and he read the demands. Those have been heard previously on this program, so I won't attempt to repeat them. Then there was some further discussion of whether or not this meeting should attempt to reach conclusions. Several men said that they believed that while this group might profitably reach sense of the group conclusions, they should not take formal decisions, particularly because the Academic Senate meeting is on Monday. Then several professors raised the problem of what they should attempt to do. Should they attempt to uphold the strike, whatever they feel about it? One professor said that, as the demands are presently phrased, he doesn't know how long the strike might go on, whether the students mean it to go on until every demand that they have phrased has been met. Bob Mundy's stood up again and said that he doesn't know. Then the same professor raised the problem of the lack of parliamentary procedures when the mass meeting in Sproul Plaza today voted to continue the strike. Mario Savio was at the meeting, and he stood up and replied that mass democracy is not democratic, but that under the circumstances it was the only way to deal with the question, and that as long as the vote was as overwhelming as it was, he felt that it was indeed representative. Professor Morris Hirsch of mathematics, a member of the faculty who spoke at the noon rally today and has made clear his support of the strike, returned again to the problem of what to do about the strike as such. He said that it might seem to some that a strike is absurd because it seems to hurt only the students, but on the other hand, that the meeting tonight makes clear that the faculty also finds a student strike intolerable. He said he couldn't explain what the reasons were for that. Perhaps the psychologist could. He said that the most important thing about this seemed to be that a strike is, as it very often has been in collective bargaining, an attempt to get not only specific goals, but legitimization of the bargaining process, that is, to gain some sort of legitimate position for a group, that whether or not it obtains its goals, it is at least considered a legitimate group to put forth demands, to raise proposals, and so forth. Professor Hirsch concluded that he himself is not going to hold his class, at least tomorrow, that he intends to meet with his students on Saturday, that while that might seem a kind of nitpicking way of dealing with the problem, he could see no other way to deal with the problem of supporting the strike, but at the same time keeping the students from lacking the instruction they need in the last week before final exams. Just before I left to make this call, the Chancellor's Special Assistant, John Searle, returned to say that the Chancellor would not be able to come to this meeting, that he will speak to the Academic Senate meeting on Monday, and that he could meet with this entire group or representatives of it over the weekend. The response to that was, I suppose, a little cool. The faculty members did not sneer or hiss or do anything like that, but the Mr. Searle was certainly not greeted with a very friendly fashion. That's developments up to about this minute. I would be inclined to doubt that very formal decisions will come from this meeting, but if they do, we will attempt to report on them before the end of the night. At the rate the meeting has been going on, they may not be done before we go off the air. This is Scott Keach from the Berkeley campus of the University of California.
This is Scott Keach back in the studio. Since I made that call a half hour, 45 minutes ago, that meeting has come to an end. It did not reach what might be considered substantive conclusions. A couple of motions were put on the floor in the course of the meeting, but none was acted on. Eventually, in a sort of non-formal fashion, a four- or five-man committee was delegated to attempt to meet with Chancellor Hines and to get Chancellor Hines to arrange a meeting with the group that had met tonight, or preferably with a somewhat larger group that this group might attempt to gather from the faculty as a whole, and that it should attempt to meet before the Academic Senate meeting on Monday. The impression I got of the meeting tonight was that while a great many faculty members were not at all clear about what kind of actions they could take as a body, and that while quite a number were not clear about what would be the best response to the strike, the kind of discussion that went on, for example, about what to do about classes with only a week and one day before classes come to an end, that for all that, the group tonight was quite strongly opposed to the actions that the administration has taken, not only in calling in the police. This was, of course, what aroused the faculty most in December 1964, but also that this time, unlike 1964, there was much more feeling among faculty members that the students had not responded in a fashion that was irresponsible or just too strong or any number of irresponsible, illegitimate ways, that the student response was, as some of the faculty members made explicit, something that they thought was about all the students could have done. What kinds of actions that might lead to, obviously, is for seers to predict or something. But it is at least significant, I think, that the faculty mood does seem to be different from that of 1964. Having said that, I should also note that this was a relatively small minority of the faculty, and that as the meeting went on, a considerable number of the faculty members left. Whether they left because they were opposed to those who gave the meeting the kind of tenor I have described, or because they wanted quicker movement to action or what, obviously I couldn't tell. They didn't stand up and announce that they were leaving for such and such a reason. Also, since I made the call of a few minutes ago, I've discovered that another meeting was going on at about the same time. This is a meeting of the student government because of the physical impossibility of being in two places at one time. I was not able to cover that one, and I don't know what happened there. However, some members of the student government had met with the chancellor and were to report to that meeting of the student government on their meeting with Chancellor Hines. I have no information on what went on. I would anticipate that the student government meeting might have been quite heated, since the vote to support the strike was apparently 9-8 last night, and so therefore opposition would be very strong. Now, the chancellor's meeting with the students reportedly ended at about 9 p.m. His assistant, John Searle, returned to that meeting of the faculty at roughly 11, saying that the chancellor was in a meeting at that time. He didn't say with whom. There is the Special Committee of the Academic Senate, which was empowered in 1964 to act, to some extent at any rate, without returning to the Academic Senate for prior approval. And it's possible that he was meeting with that committee or with leaders of the Academic Senate or department heads, but I don't know. We'll probably have information on that tomorrow. And that does seem to bring us up to as close to this moment as we can get.
All listeners, students and non-students alike, have come to depend on KPFA for coverage of important local events which presents fairly and in depth differing points of view. Only KPFA does this. Long, expensive hours and time and lack of sleep by staff and volunteers is the price for this coverage. Without us, you could not hear what is really being said. Without your financial help, we cannot do this important broadcasting. So we ask you to subscribe or send a contribution now to KPFA, Berkeley 4. Coverage at the university and narration were by Scott Keach, Bob Graham, and Bert White. Technical production was by Dan McCloskey, Nick Hawes, Seth Curlin, and Bob Bergstresser. The program was produced by Bob Graham and Bert White.